From Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Layla Hawkins, and today I'm joined by Dr. Rachel Clark, a palliative care consultant and author, to talk, amongst other things, about her new book, Dear Life. Dear Life is your second book. Your first book, Your Life in My Hands, was about your experiences as a new doctor working for an NHS in crisis. But in this book, you're focusing on your experiences working in palliative care. Why did you decide to write it?
Well, it felt very, very important to me to try and write about palliative medicine because although the one thing all of us knows is going to happen to us is the end of our life one day. We're all mortal. That's an essential part of being human. Nevertheless, there's an enormous amount of fear and taboo around the topic of death and dying. That's completely understandable. It's a daunting topic, I think, for anybody. But as a palliative care doctor, I've seen in so many ways the unintended harm and suffering that can come from not talking openly and gently about our own mortality. And I believed very strongly that in trying to explore these issues and have a wider conversation about dying, perhaps I might be able to take away some of that suffering that really doesn't need to be there.
In the book, you describe how your, at the time, future husband's mother died in a hospital, and seeing the care that she received was perhaps something that unknowingly sealed your fate as a palliative care doctor. And you describe palliative care as medicine at its best, placing the patient, not the disease, center stage. What were your early days as a palliative care doctor like?
Well, they were very, very daunting because although I passionately felt as though palliative medicine was this extraordinary privilege as a doctor, you only die once. Everybody only has one experience of dying. And so the imperative to try and help people's experiences of dying be as pain-free and suffering-free and full of gentleness and dignity and kindness and meaning as possible, that's an extraordinary thing to do. When I started, although I believed all of that in theory, I didn't know what it was going to be like every day going into work and being surrounded by people who are dying, who are reaching the end of their life. I didn't know if I would have it within myself to cope with that or to find myself burdened by it, feeling I didn't know if I would feel emotionally overwhelmed, maybe I wouldn't be cut out for it. And so it was daunting, but I think in my first few weeks, I looked around at all the other staff with whom I worked, the incredible nurses on the ward, the other doctors I worked with, all of the members of the team, the physiotherapists, the occupational therapists, the chaplain, the dietitian, everybody was united with this one simple aim, which was how do we help these individuals in the last days or weeks of their lives live as fully and richly as they possibly can? That is the only thing that matters in a hospice and in palliative care. And I realized pretty much from day one that to be worrying about myself and whether or not I could cope in this environment was the absolute height of indulgence. I had a job to do, and my job, like everyone else in the team, was to care for my patients and try and enable them to die with as much grace and dignity as is humanly possible. And so actually, after the first few days, it was easy because there was no way I was going to allow myself to be anxious. I was going to focus on the job in hand, and it has been an absolute privilege to work in medicine.
One of the quotes that I really love from the book is, if neurosurgeons are the rock stars of the medical hierarchy, then palliative care doctors are the dowdy support act. Given the importance of what palliative care doctors do, why do you think they're viewed like this?
Well, it's very interesting, and there is no denying that we, the palliative care team, are the dowdy support act. We have low status in the hospital. We are definitely not the glamorous end of medicine. We don't go to parties and sort of have people fall at our feet when we reveal that we're a dashing cardiothoracic or brain surgeon. In fact, quite the opposite. When you mention you're a specialist in palliative medicine, people usually slightly flinch away from you at parties and say things like, I don't know how you could do that. I think, in a sense, from day one of medical school and then all the way through a medical career, doctors are encouraged in many ways to view death as a failure, as our own personal failing as a profession, as a group of doctors. From day one of medical school, you are taught how to save lives, how to diagnose illness, how to fix that illness, and ideally save your patient's life. You're not taught to think about patients as human beings, and you're not taught to think about things like the enormity of confronting your humanity, your mortality, sorry, from the inside out. And so, of course, palliative medicine is going to end up shoved to the peripheries of medicine and perceived as this sort of vague and maybe slightly sinister, slightly dark and gloomy aspect of medicine. Who would want to choose a specialty that is defined by failure, in inverted commas, by the absence of cure? But of course, actually, if you reframe medicine and if you regard the goals of medicine as being all about alleviating human suffering and enabling human health and function in the very widest sense, then palliative medicine has an absolutely crucial role to play, because people's fears around their own mortality and their fears of symptoms, difficult, challenging symptoms when they are dying, are very profound. So there's an enormous amount of good you can do there, albeit not the kind that gives you the wow factor at dinner parties.
This must also feed into death being viewed as a taboo subject by the general public and people not feeling able to talk about it, if the medical profession themselves are viewing it in this way.
Yes, I very much agree with that. I think it's important to remember that doctors are not just these, hard-bitten professionals. Doctors are human beings too. Doctors experience grief and loss and witness the deaths of their family members, their loved ones, just like anyone else. And actually, none of us, I would suggest, in modern British culture are really taught how to confront all of that. And perhaps the very simplest fact that it is okay to fall apart with grief. It is okay to be overwhelmed by loss and suffering. It's okay not to know what to say to somebody who has just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. It's okay to be terribly fearful that you might say the wrong thing and you might somehow make it worse for that individual by saying the wrong thing. None of that is openly acknowledged, and it's certainly not often openly acknowledged within the medical profession. You are not taught those really important messages at medical school, and so you come out and you emerge as freshly fledged doctors with an enormous amount of anxiety about saying the wrong thing to somebody who is dying or who has a diagnosis of terminal illness. Your greatest fear, I think, is not necessarily a taboo of death per se. It is the fear of hurting somebody, of harming somebody by saying the wrong thing. And unless that is confronted and we all as a profession make concerted efforts to help new doctors and experienced doctors feel much more comfortable having these conversations, then in a sense, doctors are almost modelling how not to do it. If they are awkward and shifty and lost for words and use euphemisms and skirt around the facts of death and dying, they are almost setting a bad example, perhaps, to the wider public, that somehow this topic is to be avoided and shied away from. I think doctors can do enormous good by trying to do the opposite, setting an example that it is okay to talk about all of these things, and it's actually okay to get it wrong, to talk about it clumsily. I think the act of attempting to communicate and connect with another human being who is going through grief or loss or terminal illness is itself so powerful and so therapeutic. And not getting the words 100% quite right are not as important as the effort of trying to communicate.
In the book, there's also a chapter where you're talking about the lack of beds at the hospital where you were working initially, and you describe patients having to wait in the corridors to the point where hospital trusts recruit doctors specifically to work in something called corridor medicine. Were you expecting to face conditions like this when you were studying to become a doctor?
I absolutely wasn't, and I still, even having now been a doctor for 10 years, find it absolutely breathtaking that in a rich, civilized society such as Britain, it is possible for us to leave patients languishing in pain and fear and often life-threatening extremists on trolleys in corridors in our hospitals. That is just completely unacceptable and inhumane. It's barbaric in a rich society. We can do better than that. Mm-hmm. For our most vulnerable members of society, people who are seriously ill. And it is an absolute travesty that in 2020, people are trapped on trolleys in corridors. They are sometimes dying on trolleys in corridors. There are documented deaths of patients in that situation this winter in NHS hospitals, and it is wholly wrong. And this is not a party political point. This is an NHS point. I find it staggering that any government, whatever their political persuasion, would allow this to happen. How can they not fund the NHS sufficiently to stop people dying on a trolley or in a lift or being shunted from one overcrowded part of the hospital to another? If there is one metric of a civilized society, it should be the compassion and care with which we treat each other as we die. And that means ensuring nobody in Britain should ever, ever die on a trolley in a hospital. It's totally wrong.
Absolutely. And then when you began working in palliative care, how did it differ? What were your initial thoughts compared to working in a busy NHS hospital?
The most striking difference between palliative medicine and the other medical specialties, I would argue, is that in palliative medicine, the whole ethos is about putting the patient and what matters to them center stage. Whereas, sadly, I think in many other areas of medicine, actually it is diseased body parts that take center stage. It is your failing heart or your cirrhotic liver or your chronically diseased kidneys that become the focus of the medical endeavor. In palliative medicine, in a sense, the diagnosis, the underlying cancer or illness that has brought somebody into our care, is the least important aspect of that person. What really matters is, how do they feel? What would they like to achieve in their final days or weeks or months of life? What matters to them? How can we help them fulfill that? How can we get things right for them and create an environment in which they can feel as healthy as it is humanly possible to feel, even as you approach the end of your life? And so there are 1,001 little things that are never considered on an ordinary hospital ward, things like whether or not that patient would like to get outside and feel fresh air on their cheeks, because actually, if you're dying, that can be profoundly important. And there's no reason why somebody can't get outside, even if they're desperately ill in the last days of their life. You just have to have the imagination to help them be wheeled outside on their hospital bed. Would they like a massage? Would they like a jacuzzi? Would they like an expensive bath bomb in their jacuzzi? These are all tiny little acts that are omnipresent in many hospices but don't exist at all in an ordinary hospital ward. And they're not just simple experiences, they are all ways of communicating to a dying patient that they matter, that they're valuable, that they are precious to us, and crucially, they're all a way of communicating that you care about your patients and that they are held and surrounded by a caring community of nurses and doctors and volunteers and all the other members of the team whose mission is to try and make patients feel safe and secure and that they matter at the end of their lives.
And the hospice sector is also facing a financial crisis at the moment. What do you think needs to change there?
Well, the current funding model for palliative medicine is staggeringly inappropriate, in my opinion. Most people assume that palliative medicine is predominantly NHS funded. We're all familiar with the phrase cradle to grave to describe NHS care. And if only that were the case, the vast majority of hospices in the UK, and hospices provide care that reaches out into people's homes all across communities, the vast majority of them are charities that receive only a tiny fraction of their funding from the NHS. So, for example, my hospice, Catherine House Hospice, which is a wonderful hospice in Oxfordshire, only receives a quarter of their funding from the NHS, and that means they have to raise £3.5 million every year from voluntary donations from the local community to keep going. And the fundraising efforts are just astonishing in the local community. There are so many people and local businesses doing their utmost to keep our services going. But at the end of the day, there is no other part of the NHS where our ability to keep providing our service depends on whether or not the local jumble sale that weekend earned enough money. The funding is so precarious and it's shrinking year by year. So many hospices are finding either the amount of money they receive from the NHS is static or it's actually going down. And this is even as the population ages, it grows, and there's an increasing demand for good quality palliative care. I think this is completely wrong. I think it is inhuman that the NHS and by extension the government is not properly funding palliative medicine. Most politicians will talk the talk about wanting everybody to have as much dignity and comfort as at the end of their lives as possible. But why is that talk not being backed up by proper funding? It's just madness that we are a rich society, we are ostensibly a civilized society, and yet we are not providing that NHS funded care for people who are dying. I desperately wish that would change.
The book also covers the death of your father a few years ago. Obviously, we know there is no one size fits all when it comes to grief, but how was your experience of coming to terms with the loss of your father?
Well, I was really keen to try and write as honestly about this as I could in the book, and that was for the reason that even though I was a palliative medicine doctor, I saw dying and grief and the fallout of grief for families every day of my working life. None of that actually prepared me for how searing and painful and just shocking grief would be personally for me when I lost my father. And I thought it was very telling that no amount of professional experience prepared me for that personally. I was just undone by the grief. I couldn't believe how it seized you. It kind of hijacked you. It left me so often beyond reason, beyond rationality. It made me feel like a little child again, somebody who had no control over her emotions. And that was shocking. It was so visceral and raw for me. And I believed it was important to write about that. I think sometimes doctors believe that they must present themselves to their patients as kind of wise and omniscient and entirely in control of their emotions at all times. And while I definitely aspire to always being like that when I'm caring for the patient in front of me, actually, I think it's really important to acknowledge that doctors are human beings too, and mm-hmm. can be as undone by grief as anyone else. Grief is so individual. It hits everybody in a different way. And I wanted to be honest about how devastating it was for me, because I felt as though then I hoped almost be modeling the honesty with which I would suggest it can be helpful potentially for everybody to talk about death, dying, and its impact on us. If I'm going to suggest that having that conversation is a helpful thing to do, then the very least I need to do is be honest myself about how it felt for me, even if that risks feeling rather vulnerable and opened up in the process. So it was really important for me to write about that as honestly as I could.
Mm. Did you find that your father's death changed the way that you viewed the grief of your patients' families?
So much so. And I was blown away by this. Before my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer, I had always thought of myself as a reasonably empathetic doctor. I thought I tried hard to understand things from my patients and their families' points of view. However, what I discovered when I went through the experience of grief myself was actually how much I was unintentionally making judgments about other people's grief. I almost had in my head an internal hierarchy of who was allowed to feel grief most strongly. Right. And I was really ashamed of that when I recognized that in myself. So, for instance, if you are a parent and you are grieving for the loss of a young child, that in my kind of internal unconscious hierarchy seemed to be the most devastating kind of loss, the kind of loss you would feel most keenly. Whereas perhaps if you were losing a grandparent who was in their 90s, then perhaps you shouldn't grieve so strongly because somehow that person had lived a good long life. And so it was more the natural order of things for them to reach the end of their life. What I discovered when I experienced grief myself was it just blew all of that out of the water. And I recognized how unintentionally judgmental I had been privately in my mind. I think that grief is intimately tied up with how much we love somebody. The more you love someone, the more painful and searing it is to lose them. And that is what defines how strongly and how keenly someone experiences grief. And as a doctor, my one crucial job is to respect whatever patients and their families are feeling and never, ever presume to judge that. But it took the personal experience of grief myself to really appreciate those unconscious judgments I had been making myself. And so I hope that I'm now a better doctor, a more sensitive and empathetic doctor, having been through that experience.
How much of your role as a doctor would you say is listening to your patients' stories, whether it's their fears or how they're feeling?
So I believe that listening is the absolute bedrock of good medicine. I'm not unique in thinking that. So famously, William Osler, late 19th century professor of medicine, urged his medical students to just listen to their patients. That is what he told them, just listen, because invariably, through paying close attention to what your patient is telling you, you will be able to diagnose what is wrong with them. You don't need a fancy molecular genomics test, latest scan, and so on. Usually from the patient's story, you will have a very good idea of what might be wrong with them. And I have always found that personally, the critical thing in making a diagnosis, it's not even laying a hand on a patient, it's not even examining them, it's listening to what they tell you. And on top of that, I believe very strongly that there is a really vital role that listening can play. It is the most powerful way that you as a clinician can communicate that you respect your patient, you care about them, they matter to you, and you are giving them your full undivided attention for all those reasons. You are putting them center stage. There is so much of a modern hospital that makes a patient feel precisely the opposite. Lying on a trolley in an A&E corridor, for example, is a very effective way of making a patient feel as though they don't matter at all. But being in crowded, busy, hectic environments where everybody is running around in a frenzy because there aren't enough doctors, there aren't enough nurses, all of that communicates to patients that they don't matter, they are a burden, they are a problem to be raced through as quickly as possible. If you can actually take a moment, sit down and listen to your patients, you are communicating the opposite. And at the end of the day, it's that that makes the doctor-patient relationship therapeutic.
Have there been any patient stories that have particularly affected you emotionally, perhaps?
I think probably like most doctors, I will carry around in my head until the day I die so many experiences of with patients that have really touched me to my core.
Right.
I can think of a great many patients that I've cared for in palliative medicine. One example is a young woman I cared for last year in my hospice who had metastatic breast cancer, and she was frightened, very frightened, because her cancer had spread to her brain and she was terrified that she was going to lose herself. Her brain tumours were going to eat away at her personality, her memories, her whole sense of herself, and she would disappear from this world. She had a son and she couldn't bear the thought of that happening and being witnessed by her young son. When she came to the hospice and she gave me permission to tell her story, she wanted people to hear her story. She found that one of the most helpful and therapeutic experiences was actually to be surrounded by the outside world, the natural world around her, where she could see all of the cycles of nature, the dawn of each new day, dusk at the end of the day, the seasons turning, these endless cycles of life and death that are a part of an inescapable part of this natural world we inhabit, and somehow finding herself or locating herself in these natural cycles as a living thing that herself was also coming to the end of her life cycle gave her an enormous sense of solace. And she confronted her final days of life with this extraordinary, hard-fought sense of peace and dignity and simply love for the people around her. She cared so much more for her husband, her son, and the rest of her family than she ever did for herself. And I take that example with me wherever I go now in medicine. It seemed to me that here was a woman who just exemplified the very best of human nature, all the strength and quiet dignity that a human being is capable of. And it's impossible to not be touched by that and not to be humbled and astonished, really, by what human beings are capable of.
That is remarkable. Now, your father was a doctor, but you didn't initially follow in his footsteps. You first became a TV journalist, and you covered some quite hard-hitting subjects, like the civil war in Congo, for example. So what led you to that line of work?
Well, at its simplest, from very early childhood onwards, I loved words, writing. I devoured books. I was obsessed with choosing my 8 books every weekend from the library. I couldn't believe you were allowed so many. And I loved trying to express myself in words. I was always writing stories from a very early age. And then as I became older, I could see the power of words, the fact that as a journalist, in telling a human story, you could not only describe the world, but you might be able to change the world as well. And that's a very idealistic reason for going into journalism. But I believed that in trying to tell stories, to bring people's stories to light, that was a way of doing good. And it was also a wonderfully creative way to satisfy this love of words, writing stories that I had deep within. And so I chose writing because I saw it as a way of doing something meaningful that I could feel proud of with my life. I always wanted to try and do some good in my life. And going out into countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where at the time there was a raging civil war that had claimed more civilian lives than some of the most serious world wars in we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. That's a really fulfilling thing to do. Also, I have to say, terribly frightening and not at all what I ever imagined myself doing. Being shot at by child soldiers in the Congo, I think you have to be a very unusual type of character to enjoy that. I most definitely didn't. But actually, it was so fulfilling to come away with footage that ended up being shown in the United Nations, was used as evidence against some of the war criminals in the International Criminal Court. And that was an extraordinary thing to do. It felt like a real achievement.
But then at what point did you decide that you'd had enough of trying to change the world and instead wanted to be a doctor?
Well, the interesting thing about trying to change the world through words, through journalism, was, although in the abstract that was a wonderfully worthwhile idealistic aim, actually in the concrete, my day-to-day job, it was a hard job for me to do, that I don't think I was really ultimately cut out for. You have to be tough as nails in some ways to be a good journalist, and I think I was a little bit too soft, too worried about what other people thought of me. And at the same time, as the years went by, I felt more and more strongly as though what I really should have done, what really would fulfill me, actually was medicine. That was something I'd always considered as a child, but I found it very hard to know how much I genuinely wanted to be a doctor and how much I was just following in the footsteps of my father and thinking about medicine because I was one of those kids who was good at science at school.
Right.
So that feeling just grew and grew. But once I'd made the decision, it just felt right. And from day one of medical school, I felt as though I was doing the thing I was born to do. And I've never lost that feeling. I absolutely love being a doctor, in a way that actually I never did love being a journalist. It's just sometimes hard to figure that out at the time.
Well, Rachel, thank you very much for joining us today. Your book, Dear Life, is out this week.
It is indeed. And thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.